Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Bueno, buenas noches. Gracias por acompañarnos esta noche en este evento que tengo el gusto de presentar a Sylvie Simmons, periodista, escritora británica, pionera entre las mujeres que se aventuraron a hacer periodismo del rock. Y esto en los años 70 era una aventura bastante quijotesca, si se tiene en cuenta que esta actividad era netamente una actividad masculina. Sylvie nace en Londres, en un momento privilegiado, porque le toca ser testigo de la irrupción de lo que se puede considerar la edad de oro del rock inglés. Y estamos hablando del momento en que The Beatles, The Who y por supuesto los Rolling Stones aparecen hacia el año 63, dejándonos una música maravillosa. Y en ese ambiente Sylvie crece en un hogar lleno de música y con unos deseos muy grandes de potencializar esa pasión por la música desde muy joven. Y ya entrada en el tiempo, cuando se va del Reino Unido y se radica en Los Ángeles, empieza a trabajar como escritora freelance para diferentes medios de comunicación, empieza a girar con algunas bandas reconocidas, entre ellas Black Sabbath, AC/DC, Def Leppard, Iron Maiden, con quienes tiene el gusto de compartir, y empieza literalmente a cazar estrellas y a tener contacto con nombres muy importantes en la historia del rock. Y en el año 2012, tras haber publicado una serie de biografías anteriores como Serge Gainsbourg y Neil Young, Sylvie, tras 3 años de una investigación muy ardua, logra la publicación de este libro, Soy tu hombre, la vida de Leonard Cohen, el célebre poeta, compositor y cantante canadiense. Y es un gusto tenerla acá en Colombia, a Sylvie, por primera vez. Y lo primero que quisiera preguntarte, Sylvie, es ¿cuál es el primer recuerdo musical que tienes de Leonard Cohen? Bienvenida.
Thank you. It's lovely being in Cartagena. Well, my first memory of Leonard Cohen's music is something I won't forget because a girl never forgets her first. And what it was that it was the day I hit puberty and I was sitting on the bed with a bellyache. So one of the side effects of puberty.
You
can't hear me?
To the microphone.
Oh, closer. Okay. I think it's because I can hear myself so loudly in here. I'll take it off while I'm speaking. Okay, shall we try this again? Is this better? All right. You can hear the whole sad tale again. It was, I was living in London, as Hako said, and it was the day I hit puberty. I'd bought, oh, peas are bad on this, we should know this, puberty. And it was the day that I bought a compilation album, a very cheap compilation album, because I was a kid and couldn't afford real albums. And there was one song on there by Leonard Cohen called Sisters of Mercy. And sitting there clutching my poor little belly, which was aching like all hell, this music suddenly, like the sound of a cathedral, lifted me up and pinned me to the wall. And I had no idea what he was really singing about, but there was something in him that seemed to have an intimacy and an authority that made me think he knew something. I'm going to follow this guy.
Como periodista que tuvo el gusto de hablar con una cantidad de músicos, les hablo de Robert Plant, de Led Zeppelin, Mick Jagger, de los Rolling Stones, por supuesto, Johnny Cash, David Bowie. ¿En qué momento, como periodista, es tu primera aproximación a Leonard Cohen y bajo qué circunstancias?
The first time I met Leonard Cohen, actually, wasn't the first time I'd spoken to him. We'd done some phone interviews. At that time, I was in London. He was wherever he was, usually in Los Angeles. And so we spoke by phone. And the first time that I met him, really spent time with him, was when he came down from living for 5.5 years in a monastery on Mount Bodhi, which I should say is the ugliest mountain on earth. And he was living there for 5.5 years. I went to stay there for 3 days. And I actually emailed him and said, I'm going to hell. I stole a spoon from the cafe and I'm digging an escape tunnel. I don't know how you did 5.5 years. But he came down from the monastery and he made an album in 2001 called 10 New Songs. He came to London and we did an interview that lasted for 3 days. And so it was like no nights, by the way, but 3 days. And we'd come back and we'd spend hours and hours talking. And at the end of it, I was going back through the transcript and thought, wow, he has managed to wriggle out of so many questions. There's so much mystery left here. He's a professional hypnotist, really, and a charmer. And so I thought at that moment, well, one day I'll write a book on him, but I put it off for a while.
Y ahora que usted habla de hipnotismo, recuerdo perfectamente en el primer capítulo del libro de esta biografía que se titula Nacido con traje, hay una anécdota maravillosa de Leonard Cohen con un pequeño libro de hipnotismo y algo que sucede en su casa al poco tiempo que fallece su padre, que era un sastre, reconocido sastre en la ciudad de Montreal, una de las razones por las cuales siempre vemos a Leonard Cohen también vestido, es algo de tradición. Y hay algo que sucede en la casa con este pequeño libro de hipnotismo, Silvi. ¿Qué es lo que pasa?
Ah, the hypnotism book. Leonard gave me access to his archives, and I was digging through there and found all sorts of strange things that may or may not mean anything. But one thing that really did was a hypnotism book that he mentioned in his first novel, The Favorite Game. And he said that as a child in the novel, which is very autobiographical, that he had learned how to hypnotize from a book. And the first thing he did was hypnotize his dog. And when that worked very easily, because Leonard had a natural talent with mesmerism, he hypnotized the family maid. And either, you know, ignoring or, you know, actually obeying the instructions of the book to only use it for educational purposes, he instructed the maid to undress. This was when he was around 13. He told me he'd already been obsessed with girls for about 2 years. And I'm sure the maid just undid 2 buttons, but that was enough for Leonard. So what was most interesting to me, though, is I read this book. It was a very thin book. And my eyes opened by about chapter 3, which was how to hypnotize a room full of people. And it was almost like, you know, those idiot guides book, you know, idiot guides to Pro Tools or, you know, Confucius. It was the idiot guide to being Leonard Cohen, because it said, you must be slow and deliberate in all of your actions. Let your voice grow lower, lower, till just above a whisper. Do not hurry, or you will fail. And all of these things sounded so much of what you get when you're in Leonard's presence in his house, or whether you're in a room with him where he's performing. That is Leonard. So either he was drawn to hypnotism naturally because that was his tendency, or somehow he picked up a few words from that book.
Hay una anécdota en la temprana adolescencia de Leonard Cohen que, si ustedes recuerdan, cuando le fue concedido el premio Príncipe de Asturias en el año 2011, y el video circula en YouTube, que es un, realmente es un discurso muy bonito, muy emotivo, Cohen recuerda con muchísimo cariño algo que le sucede en su temprana adolescencia, y es la aproximación a un gitano, guitarrista español que deambulaba por las calles de Montreal, pero que a la larga sería determinante en la carrera musical de Leonard Cohen. ¿Cómo es la historia de este guitarrista flamenco, Silvi?
Ah, well, it's strange because Spain and everything to do with Spanish language, it's played a great important part in Leonard Cohen's life. You think that because he's from Montreal, it would be French, but like I am, like I'm English, we have a very strange command of the French language that we learn at school. But Spaniards and Spain were what appealed to him. When he was 15 years old, before this incident with the guitar player that you mentioned, there was what I call the Big Bang of Leonard Cohen. And what happened is he was walking past a bookshop, a used bookshop, and outside he saw a book of the collected poems of Lorca. And he said that when he picked it up and started reading, the little hairs stood up on his arm. And he said, I heard the music of the synagogue. And that same year, he was age 15, he bought a classical guitar. He kind of took to it very easily in a way because he had played a ukulele beforehand and it just had two more strings, so it wasn't so difficult for him to do. But he didn't really take lessons until he heard this young man, actually not on the streets of Montreal, but in this gorgeous huge park that it was right at the back of the, you know, rather expensive house that Leonard's family lived in. And he was more drawn to the young man because women were drawn to the young man as he played. And he went down and spoke to him, and spoke to him in broken French because he couldn't speak Spanish at the time and the young man couldn't speak English. And he asked him to give him some lessons. And as Leonard told it, this young man came to his house and taught him some basic flamenco moves and some beautiful chord progressions. And this happened 3 or 4 occasions, and then the man didn't turn up. And Leonard traced him back to where he was staying in Montreal, and the landlady at that hostel said, oh, he killed himself, the young man had died. So Leonard had this incomplete but very romantic idea of guitars at that point, which fused very much with his love of the poetry of Lorca.
No nos podemos salir de España sin mencionar a Federico García Lorca, que fue fundamental cuando Cohen, en su temprana adolescencia, en 1950, tiene acceso a los poemas selectos de Lorca. ¿Qué tan importante fue la poesía de Lorca en el desarrollo como escritor y como poeta en Leonard Cohen?
Well, as Leonard described it to me, and I think various friends of his went along with this, he'd tried to be a poet at a very young age. Again, Cohen likes to say it's because that was, you know, if you girls were attracted to poets, and this was kind of pre-rock star time. You know, he was born in 1934, so when he was 11 years old, there really wasn't any rock starness. He didn't want to get a guitar at that stage. But he said the kind of poetry that he emulated and copied, and probably very badly, he said, was the kind of poems you're taught in English schools, because Montreal and Canada at that point, the English school system was modeled on the UK school. So he was reading poets like Wordsworth, you know, the usual suspects, some Byron. But he said that when he read Lorca, when he bought this book and studied Lorca, he said it gave him permission to have a voice of his own. He said in the beginning he might have slightly tried to copy Lorca, but nobody could do that. But somehow it gave him a voice. And certainly in his early poems that I read in his archives, he actually would title them with the title Ballad, like Lorca would. And you could see the influence there.
Hay un aspecto muy interesante en ese Cohen que ya a mediados de los años 50 empieza a desarrollarse como poeta tras sus estudios en la Universidad de McGill, y es el exilio. Empiezan los viajes a Grecia, a Londres, a Cuba, pasa por Israel, Nueva York. ¿Qué pasa en ese momento, en ese Cohen que está buscando como establecerse, pero que de alguna manera no puede ser nómada? Es nómada, perdón, en vez de ser una persona sedentaria, y empieza a ir de un lado a otro. Y justamente en Grecia, en ese periplo y en ese exilio, por así decirlo, conoce a una de sus primeras musas, Marianne, a quien le dedica una hermosísima canción, So Long, Marianne. Hablemos un poco del exilio en la vida de Leonard Cohen.
Ah, well, we're kind of like speed dating Leonard Cohen style here, because it started a lot earlier. He had left initially to go to Columbia University in New York, and one of his first muses there was a young lady called Anne, for whom he wrote the poem for Anne. And there were always muses, there were always women in Leonard Cohen's life, but what is very patently evident about him when you spend any time with him or study him is that, yes, he loved women horizontally. We all know about that. But he also loved them vertically and every angle in between. Women were multi-purpose for Leonard. He loved working with them. He adored them in every way. So many, many muses were there. But as for the traveling, it was very interesting. Leonard's family, you'd mentioned his father was a tailor. Actually, he wasn't. He owned an extremely high-end, expensive suit company specializing in very grand English-style suits, which Leonard's father wore and Leonard did himself. But the family had money. They had status. They had prestige. And he could easily have worked in one of the many family businesses. But instead, he decided he would make all of his money from writing, which usually meant writing applications for a grant, because in Canada, they would give grants to a lot of their artists. So he became a professional grant writer. And at one point, after sort of not really doing very well at Columbia University, because he just wanted to write about himself, his whole thesis was going to be on his own work, he managed to get a grant to go to the major capitals of Europe and just do a whole, just a book on the major capitals of Europe. Simple as that, his thoughts. And he went to Israel briefly, and then he went to Greece and London. Well, actually, London first. And he spent a winter there. Anybody who's spent in a winter in London will know you don't want to stay there for long. I spent many there. I'm a Londoner. And he moved to Greece and lived on a Greek island, which is, as you say, where he met Marianne, probably the most famous of his musical muses, other than Suzanne.
Sí. Y justamente Cohen, casi que por necesidad, porque sus libros no eran tan exitosos, empieza a una carrera musical como compositor y como cantante a la edad de 33 años, en el año 67. Le da justamente esto que mencionaba Silvi, el tema Suzanne, se la cede a Judy Collins, quien hace una versión maravillosa de esta canción, y posteriormente decide que él quiere lanzarse como cantante y arranca justamente a sus 33 años una carrera que no ha parado, que hoy en día sigue vigente. Hablemos de el Leonard Cohen cantante, compositor, el que le toca, por así decirlo, meterse en el mundo de la música.
Well, you know, the Gospels converge on all sorts of things about Leonard, but everybody, including Cohen, agrees that the reason he decided to make music was to make money. And he had decided that he was going to be a songwriter, not a singer, because nobody thought he had a good singing voice, including himself. It wasn't just being modest, you know, I was born like this, I had no choice. I was born with the gift of a golden voice. He hated his singing voice. And nearly everybody agreed with him. I spoke to his early rabbi when I was in Montreal, a really old rabbi. This rabbi had taught Leonard's bar mitzvah class. So it gives you some idea. And I asked him if Leonard had sung in the synagogue, and he looked at me like I was insane. He said, "Leonard, sing?" He was a good speaker. So he decided he was going to write songs, not sing them. And he decided he was going to write country songs. I guess there's kind of a lot of heartbreak and, you know, darkness in his songs that he figured would fit with a country melody. And actually, when he was at McGill University, he was part of a square dance trio. I don't know if that's translatable or if you know what that is, but it's a very strange phenomenon. And he wasn't even the singer in that. He was the guitarist in that. But he decided to do this, and he was going to go to Nashville. But a friend told him to pop into New York and meet this manager that he knew, a woman, interestingly, who used to work with Bob Dylan's manager. And Leonard didn't leave New York. He was entranced by the Chelsea Hotel and the lifestyle there. And he met with Judy Collins and gave her a few of his songs, and she sang two of them immediately. One was Suzanne, and one was the extremely dark dress rehearsal rag about suicide. And he thought, that's it, I can go to Nashville now. But he was signed to a record deal. And this was, you know, this era, these days he would never have been signed to a record deal because he didn't fit into any of the templates that people want. But back then it was generous times. I mean, Charles Manson got a record deal, for heaven's sake. But, you know, you got record deals, and he signed it, and therein began what he considered the misery of being a singer-songwriter.
Cuando Cohen arranca esta carrera como compositor y como cantante, particularmente podemos mencionar sus tres primeros discos, Songs of Leonard Cohen, Songs from a Room y Songs of Love and Hate. Tiene un relativo éxito comercial en Inglaterra, en Canadá, pero no en Estados Unidos. Pero finalmente, cuando el éxito llega a la vida de Leonard Cohen, hay algo muy bonito que dice en el libro, en una de las entrevistas, y es que él, para ser feliz, solamente necesita una silla, una mesa y una cama. Es una persona muy austera que con poco es feliz. Hablemos de ese rasgo tan particular a lo largo de los años en la vida de Leonard Cohen, su capacidad de adaptación a condiciones austeras, por así decirlo.
That's a long question. Let's see if I can take bits and pieces from those. Do you want me to start at the end and work backwards? Well, the thing about his success or lack of it in America had always confused me, because in England, his albums, these really dark ones, the darker they were, the higher they were in the charts. They were like number two, number one in the charts. And in further north in Europe, in Norway and Sweden and Denmark, they worship him. There's almost churches of Saint Leonard there. You know, the darkness really worked with us. It didn't work so much with North Americans. They don't like dark. It's a scary place to go. And so they preferred the kind of more obvious humor and self-deprecation of the album I'm Your Man. And I think I might have forgotten some of the other... Oh, yes, the chair and the table and the desk. Yes, Leonard, it was very interesting. I wrote a book, a biography of a French artist, songwriter, named Serge Gainsbourg. And he was somebody who was obsessed about tidiness. And the reason he was obsessed about tidiness, for example, he even had a fridge with a glass door to make sure that everything was neatly stacked, was he said that I have so much disorder in my head that I need to have order in my life. And that was very much a pattern that Leonard followed. He, this idea of having just almost like a monk-like life was perfect for him. Even now, his very modest home in Los Angeles, plain white walls, plain floors, maybe a couple of rugs, everything plain and simple. He doesn't want distractions, doesn't want to have objects or possessions. So most of his life has been wearing a uniform as well, usually a suit, and keeping this kind of very disciplined, simplified life that absolutely clashes and eases the complicated, complex man that he is. Did that answer some of it?
Sí, ya. Yeah. Okay. En los años 70, Leonard Cohen se mete en la aventura bastante osada, por así decirlo, de trabajar con Phil Spector en la producción de un álbum que se conoció como Death of a Ladies Man. Phil Spector, quien hoy en día pues, se encuentra preso, acusado de asesinato, fue reconocido en los años 60 por haber creado una cantidad de éxitos con artistas Motown, por ejemplo, con las Ronettes, y Leonard Cohen en ese momento estaba en un proceso de transición, buscando como una especie de identidad, y coincide con una situación bastante particular a finales de los años 70, y es la conversión de Bob Dylan al cristianismo. Leonard Cohen, judío, de una familia muy importante, tradicional, importantísima en Canadá para la comunidad judía, filántropos, crearon sinagogas, colegios y demás. Y hay un aspecto que siempre ha llamado la atención, Silvi, y es la relación de Leonard Cohen con Bob Dylan, particularmente cuando Dylan se convierte al cristianismo, que Leonard reacciona muy mal y furioso, dice, no puede ser esto posible, en un momento en el que además Cohen se reencuentra con el judaísmo cuando justamente presenta el libro conocido como Book of Mercy. Y hablemos también un poco además de la relación de Cohen con la religión.
Well, that's a big question. In fact, we'll do the essay answers and pass it around. This one's a tough one. But starting with Phil Spector, yes, that wasn't an identity crisis on Leonard's part any more than his usual identity crisis. Most of that being based around one of the things that has been a huge factor in his life until he hit about 70 years old. And that was that he suffered from depression, not the blues, as he said, not the blues, but waking up every morning thinking, what do I do to get through this day? How many women? What drugs? What drink? What can I do to get through this day? This is what this man went through most of his life. As his friends said, he wasn't a whiny kind of depressive. He never complained. But this was what was under the surface at all times. And at the time when he was working with Phil Spector, as he said, it's kind of like he wasn't on his best game, you know. He was not in a great state. He was drinking extremely heavily, was taking a huge amount of amphetamines, which at that point even I said, you were on speed? He said, darling, you should hear me when I'm not on speed. And so he was in a bit of a mess, and his kind of very fractious relationship with Suzanne, not the Suzanne of song, but the Suzanne who is the mother of his only two children, was really on the rocks. And so really he was in, when he met Phil Spector was a complicated man at the best of times, but he was having a drinking problem at that time, and guns were used in the making of that album. Bob Dylan, bringing him into it now, he did come into the picture again here. Leonard and he had an acquaintanceship more than a friendship. When they first met, they circled each other like cats, you know, talking in a strange language to each other. But they decided that they thought each other were worthy, and they had a vague acquaintanceship, friendship. And a very drunken Bob Dylan joined in with Allen Ginsberg on his arm, singing along to a chorus of a song on that album, which was very un-Leonard Cohen-esque in its title, which was "Don't Go Home With Your Hard On." I don't know if that's going to be well translated, with your erection, in case that doesn't work. The later, and with the, I think and I might need a relation, bit more questioning, the relationship.
Y lo otro que quería saber es, en ese momento particular, cuando lanza el Book of Mercy, ¿cómo Cohen se reencuentra con la religión? ¿Por qué es importante ese libro para él?
Right. Okay, I think I was getting a bit carried away there, because I remember that Phil Spector had said something like, we've got enough Jews in the room now, because he was Jewish too, to have a bar mitzvah or something. But he really would go, I mean, as far as Leonard was concerned, he was a Jew. He wrote a poem after he became ordained a Buddhist monk, saying, I am a Jew, I am a Jew, I am a Jew. Everything else was some kind of just a discipline or a spiritual journey that he wanted to take. But as far as he was concerned, he was a Jew. And he was horrified when Bob Dylan came out with I am a Christian all of a sudden. Leonard said, I love Jesus, but I wasn't going to stand in the shul and shout it. So this was his feeling on religion, and was this the answer? Good enough? More?
No, está bien. En los años 80, después de que Cohen saca este libro al que hacemos mención, él llega con un disco que fue famoso en su momento porque fue rechazado por la CBS, la cabeza de la compañía discográfica. Walter Yetnikoff rechaza el álbum Various Positions, que entre otras canciones trae Dance Me to the End of Love y Aleluya. Aleluya, la canción más conocida de Leonard Cohen, interpretada, reinterpretada aproximadamente unas 300 o 400 veces, que de hecho el propio Cohen dice, la han cantado tanto que ya me aburre. Finalmente, Leonard Cohen buscaba el éxito con ese disco que es rechazado por la CBS, pero de tanto lucharlo, finalmente en el año 88 con el álbum I'm Your Man, llega el éxito. Un disco que entre otras canciones tiene esta, que le da el título al álbum, I'm Your Man y First We Take Manhattan. ¿Cómo recibe Leonard Cohen en 1988 finalmente el éxito anhelado tras esa desazón que le dejó lo que pasó con Walter Yetnikoff en el 84?
Yes, that was such a strange story that they would reject an album with Alleluia on, which took over from Suzanne as the most covered of Leonard Cohen's songs. And he had to put the album out in the US on an independent label. Around the world, though, as I say, he was getting a much better reception. But I think that by that stage, Leonard Cohen had come, he did realize that, you know, this was not going to be an easy ride. He wasn't exactly giving the record companies what they felt they need to get him in the charts anymore. And they mostly left him to his own devices. But what was happening in Leonard's musical life was very interesting, because he found that he was having the worst writer's block. As an aside to this, as well as being a depressive, Leonard was cursed with one other thing, which is he was a perfectionist. And there's nothing like those two combining with being a writer. So he would write what were perfectly good songs to anybody's ears but his own, and he would go back to them over and over again for 5, 6, up to 15 years in the case of Anthem. So he had this kind of problem going on there. So all of his life was in a kind of work agony. You know, he didn't sort of suddenly wake up one morning on the right side of bed and think, I'll take a cheerful picture of myself peeling a banana with sunglasses on and be hip with the kids. There was none of that going on. He was crawling across carpets, tearing his hair, thinking, how can I finish a song? And one of the things that was helping him a little around the time of Alleluia was that he had bought a Casio synthesizer. I don't know if any of you had those, but I had one. You could buy them for virtually nothing, and you could program a little thing which would have samba sound or reggae beat, and you could just kind of make your little songs up to it and be happy. And Leonard was doing that. Because he'd broken away from his Spanish guitar, he suddenly fell in love with the keyboards, and by the time he got to I'm Your Man, he'd got it down to his own version of an art, which was those one-finger solos that are so cool.
Después del éxito que llega con el álbum I'm Your Man, Cohen en el año 93 presenta un álbum que fue muy exitoso para su carrera también, titulado The Future, en parte porque Oliver Stone para la película Natural Born Killers utiliza como tema principal la canción que da nombre al álbum, The Future. Y después de una gira bastante intensa, Cohen toma una decisión bastante fuerte pero determinante para su vida, y es la de internarse definitivamente en el monasterio del Mount Baldy en California para convertirse en un monje budista. Hablemos de esa faceta en la vida de Leonard Cohen.
Well, it was a very, very strange thing, because this was Leonard, who just turned 60 years old. He had the biggest album of his career as far as sales were concerned, because it was, you know, it came on the back of I'm Your Man. And he was also engaged to be married. This was a first. And it was to an actress, a Hollywood actress called Rebecca De Mornay. I don't know if you saw the film where she plays Psycho Nanny. Do you know the film? But she's a really wonderful, very smart woman. And so here he was, you know, with a hit album, 60 years old. Nothing could be better. And the next minute, he's in the monastery. And as Rebecca De Mornay said, it's done wonders for her reputation with men now. It's like, what did you do to him that you sent him to the monastery? Clearly, he wasn't made for marriage, but instead he decided he was going to live with his longtime friend and teacher, a Rinzai Zen Buddhist monk, who he just knew as Roshi Sasaki. And he had told me that it was because Roshi was getting old, he was nearly 90, and he wanted to spend time with him. Roshi, in the end, lived to 107, so he spent a lot of time with him. But he went into a kind of different mode. I mean, celebrities, basically, of any sort, are on this planet to be served. That's their whole thing. He went the other way. He went into service for this man. He was his cook, his chauffeur, his secretary. He even had to get a certificate in food handling from the local government, you know? So he had to study a test in that. He was devoted to this man who he'd known since about 1970 and whom he'd been going to see for 2 months every year for very strict, almost boot camp kind of Buddhist training. This wasn't one of those California spa kind of Zens. As Leonard said with a certain smile on his face, we were the Marines of the Buddhist world. And so he was up there for 5.5 years, and you know, he seemed to be very happy in that setup. He was in a cell finally. He had his little wooden hut with an extra room. He got special dispensation because he'd paid for the monastery, basically, to have a coffee machine and a computer. And at that time, he started doing lots of different experimentation with digital art as soon as the software became available for that. And as soon as things got online, as soon as the monastery went online with the old dial-up thing, he actually got interested very much in the internet and in writing various compositions on his keyboard synthesizer.
Después de ese periodo de convertirse en monje budista, vienen otros dos álbumes, 10 New Songs del año 2001, Dear Heather del año 2004. Constantemente Cohen con contacto y relación con el monasterio del Mount Baldy, con su maestro. Y de repente su hija Lorca recibe una llamada de un empleado de su oficina donde le dice que deberían dar un vistazo a su cuenta de ahorros, a la cuenta de ahorros de Leonard Cohen, que algo no estaba bien. Y para sorpresa de Cohen, se da cuenta que, estamos hablando del año 2004, solamente habían $100,000 en su cuenta, que no es una cifra despreciable, pero para un músico que para ese momento llevaba casi 35 años en el ruedo, sí era preocupante. Y aquí sucede un capítulo triste, pero a la vez interesante en la vida de Cohen, porque ese descalabro financiero por cuenta de una ex-manager lo obliga a sus 75 años casi a tener que trabajar nuevamente, a salir a la carretera, como dicen los norteamericanos, y empezar a cantar nuevamente, componer canciones, salir de gira. ¿Cómo toma esto Leonard Cohen?
Well, there's is a slightly more complicated path that goes from the monastery. He left the monastery after 5.5 years, pretty much leading all of us to believe that he'd left the monastery because he was over depression, finally. But as he told me, he left it because he was too expletive, deleted, depressed to stay there another minute. And instead he went to India and started studying with another guru out there on a regular basis. And He actually was cured of depression. He said he doesn't know how it happened. He woke up one day, he was 70 years old, and he looked out the window and saw the sunlight glinting on the cars, and it made him happy. And he thought, shit, is this how regular people feel, you know? Well, I don't really. I don't look out the window and think, God, look at the sun on the... But nonetheless, I guess most regular people perhaps do. And he was kind of, generally speaking, happy. He had another fiancé. A very young, talented woman with whom he made the album Blue Alert. But suddenly, finding out that he had lost all of his retirement accounts at the age of, it wasn't 65, it was 70. He was 70 years old. And he hadn't been on the road for 15 years because he never liked touring. That's the strange thing, he was so good at it, but he hated it. And he hated it for a couple of reasons. One was stage fright. He didn't like being on stage. And the other was he was frightened for his work. He thought that by taking this work that came so difficult to him, it was not easy to write, and honing it into a piece of work that he was proud of and that captured what he was feeling at that time, and just prostituting it on the stage night after night after night, was somehow cheapening them. So he didn't tour anymore. He just stopped for 15 years. But clearly he had to go back on the road because there was a little bit of money left in his bank, but that had already gone to lawyers because his retirement accounts had been emptied, which meant that the tax people, the Inland Revenue in America, wanted him to pay tax on those. So he was actually without any money at all at that point. And he found a very sympathetic British promoter who made him an offer he couldn't refuse. And so off he went on the road at the age of, in his 70s.
En 1974, Leonard Cohen concede una entrevista a la revista Rolling Stone, al periodista Larry Sloman, y le dice que realmente en ese momento no sabe cuánto tiempo más le queda como músico, como su carrera musical, pero da una frase que es casi que reveladora en ese momento, y decía: todo hombre debe tratar de llegar a viejo con dignidad. Y finalmente, hoy en día, Leonard Cohen tiene 80 años. El año pasado, a finales del año pasado, sacó su más reciente trabajo en estudio, titulado Popular Problems. Sale de gira nuevamente, y nuevamente éxito en el Reino Unido, éxito en Canadá, pero finalmente es exitoso en los Estados Unidos. Finalmente, a Leonard Cohen, con 80 años, le llega el éxito.
It's remarkable, isn't it? You know, most if you read rock biographies or, you know, popular music biographies, to some degree, they're all tragedies, or nearly all of them are. You know, there's somebody who has this wonderful career, and then it all goes downhill, and they die of a drug overdose or something. But suddenly, here's this man who's almost living his career backwards, in that he was playing to the biggest audiences ever, that he had ever seen. Within a few months of his comeback tour, when it started in 2008, he was playing to 100,000 people one day at the Glastonbury Festival. A lot of them young, a lot of them knowing some of the words of the song, mostly because they thought that Alleluia was, you know, the great song from Shrek movie or from the sex scene in one of the other films. But but he was loved, and he was greeted with not just a wave of love, a tsunami of love. It was a complete flood of love. And this coincided with a time when he was so grateful to be accepted, and at a time when he was over depression and could deal with the touring. And also it was a way of, in a way, obliging a sense of being of service to people. Really, it's quite strange, you know, he's almost in awe of his audiences as much as they've been in awe of him. So yes, he's also made an art of being old. I mean, does anybody look cooler than Leonard Cohen at 80? I mean, it does give us all hope somehow, you know, that we can get the sharp suit and the, you know, the Rat Pack rabbi hat. And he's just got it down. All of his little stories about on stage, he says, like, you know, in hotels, they have these big mirrors, magnifying mirrors. He said, if you are over 16, never look in a magnifying mirror. If you are over 70, die before you look in it. It was just so accurate. He's now almost making a sort of stand-up comedy in the wisest, driest way of what he's come to. But, you know, the women are flocking. When I was doing my tour, the book tour, the number of women of a certain age who were thrusting little notes with their phone numbers in my pocket, asking if I would tell Leonard to get in touch, was getting me quite blushing.
Vuelvo al libro, a la biografía como tal. Es una de las mejores biografías que se han escrito de un músico vivo, sin duda alguna. Varios periodistas especializados en música llegaron a decir que este libro no se escribió, sino que se compuso. Y un poco Silvi es como la compositora de libros. Pero hay algo adicional en el libro que es muy interesante y que ella siempre lo recalca, y es que es un libro diligente y de corazón. Y quiero que nos cuente un poco al respecto, ¿por qué lo dice?
Ah, okay, well, there's a strange thing, writing about somebody who's alive, you know, really should be outlawed in most countries, because it's a kind of stalking in a way. So, you know, it really is quite an unpleasant thing to do. You're kind of like this obsessed detective who will not drop a case that was dead years ago, you know. It's so you're constantly going after information and information. And what you realize, you know, I've been a music journalist for 37 years. I started when I was 4. is that I have to be careful with those numbers now. is that quite often the musician or the artist themselves are not the best witness in a case, because they live such a hectic and specialized and crammed with stuff life that they often remember their lives only in chapters of, oh, this was when I had this album, or this was when I had that book. And they tend to remember the press releases written about them. Time after time, I hear the press release back from somebody. So it was a case of doing due diligence, going and finding all this information out from people and from physical sources. For example, with the albums, I knew that these early albums would have been made in Columbia Studios, because he was with Columbia Records. And so, like the old movie studios, you have to make your stuff there. So I finally unearthed some boxes of details of the album work there, where I found out about all sorts of songs that were unreleased, and according to Leonard, will remain unreleased as long as he's alive. But I knew as well from writing with a person who's alive that I would have to have his involvement in some way. And that way would be not to obstruct the work, because sometimes if you read a bad biography of somebody alive, it may be that the writer isn't very good. It may be, though, that they could not get access to the people they wanted to speak to. Because when someone's alive, they'll call them up and say, Leonard, there's this crazy English woman who keeps asking me these questions. Can I answer them? And so I asked him if he would please say yes if they asked, because if I don't get my A list, I'll have a B list and it will be a bad book. And he was very supportive.
Cuando se lanza el libro, Sylvie, el mejor promotor que tiene un libro, sin duda alguna, es su autor. Y en esa, con esas ganas y esa energía, le propone a su editorial en los Estados Unidos de hacer una gira diferente, salirse del esquema tradicional de presentaciones de un presentador que presenta al autor y elogia un poco su obra y le da pues paso al autor para hablar de algunos aspectos del libro, sino quería hacer algo más allá, algo más arriesgado, ir a lugares poco convencionales como sinagogas, iglesias, bares, colegios.
I like bars.
Bares, a presentar el libro, hacer breves lecturas de algunos capítulos y acompañarlo de algunas canciones de Leonard Cohen. Y en medio de ese proceso, lectura, canto, Sylvie se da cuenta que si canta las canciones de Leonard Cohen, ¿por qué no potencializar sus pasiones y darle la vuelta al asunto y hacer lo que más le gusta, que es cantar? Y en este momento Sylvie acaba de lanzar un disco titulado simplemente Sylvie, que ha recibido las mejores críticas de la prensa británica, el Guardian, la revista NME en Estados Unidos, lo han elogiado, y en este momento con su ukelele, pues Sylvie hace lo que más le gusta. ¿Qué tan importante fue ese proceso de hacer esa gira diferente con el libro de Cohen para llegar a este momento de tu vida?
Well, it wasn't quite as well planned as what you'd mentioned. I had spent so long writing this book, and after the initial kind of year or so of going over the world to do all of the interviews and going everywhere Leonard Cohen went, which were many places, I'd sort of spent far too long indoors and I really wanted to get out. But the publishers in America, at least my publisher, was not interested in any kind of book tour. You've written the book, it's fine, it's done. I was raring to go. And because over the years so many musicians have stayed on my sofas, you know, I figured I'd stay on theirs and maybe they would come on stage with me and we'd sort of sing in record stores and anywhere we felt like. And so I just went with my ukulele, partly in a strange way. I thought I'd be very shy just reading because people would get bored and then I'd see they were bored and I'd kind of freeze. And I thought if I have a ukulele, I can kind of hide behind it. I could hide behind a guitar even more easily, but nonetheless, it's harder to carry. So I took that on the road, and partly in tribute to Leonard Cohen's love of ukulele as a child. In that episode I'd mentioned about the hypnotism book, when he saw this woman, as he said, naked, his maid who had undressed, he said she was also playing a lute, a ukulele, which he took to be a lute, and therefore she was an angel. And of course, naked angels have a portal to the divine. But so I thought I'd take my ukulele out with me, and it turned into a tour that went to Australia, Europe, Canada, everywhere that I wanted to go at that time. And at the beginning, I seen a video of one of the early ones, and I'm like, so shy. And then by the end, I'm like, yes, where's my stage? Where's my microphone? So I think that by the end of it, I've now become an absolutely impossible diva, so you should leave before I start playing.
Bueno, Sylvie, muchas gracias. Yo creo que todos acá en el público tenemos ganas de escucharla. ¿Qué le parece si ahora nos deleita con algunas canciones de Leonard Cohen y algo de su nuevo disco, por favor?
Ukes are never really in tune. I have this tuner that says on it, close enough. When you get somewhere nearer, I like that attitude.
I'm going to take my watch off because it's impossible to play with a watch on. And I'll start with a Leonard Cohen song. I'll start with the song that he started with, which is Suzanne. Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by, you can spend the night beside her, and you know that she's half crazy. That's why you wanna be there. She feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China, and just when you mean to tell her you have no love to give her, then she gets you on her wavelength. Unless the river answer that you've always been her lover, and you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you think that you can trust her, for she's touched your perfect body with her mind. And Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water, and he spent a long time watching from his lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said all men will be sailors then until the sea shall free him. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like stone. And you want to travel with him, and you want to travel blind, and you think that you can trust him, for he's touched your perfect body with his mind. Now Suzanne takes your hand and she leads you to the river. She is wearing rags and feathers from Salvation Army counters, and the sun pours down like honey on Our Lady of the Harbor. She shows you where to look among the garbage and the flowers. There are heroes in the seaweed, children in the morning, they are leaning out for love, and they'll lean that way forever while Suzanne holds a mirror. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that you can trust her, for you've touched her perfect body with your mind.
That Leonard Cohen writes a mean song. Now I'm going to sing one of mine, so following Leonard Cohen is going to be very difficult, so bear that in mind. This is a song that I wrote about San Francisco, where I live these days, and about lost love, which seems to be my usual story.
I see that you've been crying in the candlelight, and all your words have turned to smoke and lies. You never could leave, and I could never let you go. God knows how many times I tried. I'm talking to myself, 'cause you're not listening. I call your name, of course, you don't reply. I'm hurting bad, I think this might be over now. Nowhere left to go but say goodbye. But look at the moon, it's shining over Chinatown. A big blue moon spilling shadows on our skin. Come out of the dark and lay down here beside me now. And one more time go back to where we've been. I stopped believing in tomorrows, and yesterdays can only fade and die. So love me tonight before you leave me. A tear inside my heart that never dries. Look at the moon shining over Chinatown. A big blue moon spilling shadows on our skin. Come out of the dark and lay down here beside me now. And one last time, go back to where we've been.
It says good enough, so I'm going to do another Leonard Cohen song. This is possibly my favorite of his to perform, because I love it so much. It was Leonard Cohen's mother's favorite song, and its subject is something that is very close to Leonard's heart when it comes to both poetry and song, which is love triangles, but surprisingly not two women. It's always a man stealing his woman, and this beautiful song in a way is a kind of song of his to a best friend of his who clearly is having more fun with his girl than Leonard is. But it's a beautiful song called Famous Blue Raincoat. It's kind of hard for me to hear myself because there's this kind of strange noise behind me, but I'll do my best. It's 4 in the morning, the end of December. I'm writing you now just to see if you're better. New York is cold, but I like where I'm living. There's music on Clinton Street all through the evening. I hear that you're building your little house deep in the desert. You're living for nothing now. I hope you're keeping some kind of record. Yes, and Jane came by with a lock of your hair. She said,
said you gave it to her the night that you planned to go clear. Did you ever go clear? Well, the last time we saw you, you looked so much older. Your famous blue raincoat was torn at the shoulder. You've been to the station to meet every train, and then you came home without Lily Marlene, and you treated my woman to a flake of your life. When she came back, she was nobody's wife. Well, I see you there with a rose in your teeth. One more thin gypsy thief. Well, I see chains away. Sends her regards. Well, what can I tell you, my brother, my killer? What can I possibly say? I guess that I miss you. I guess I forgive you. I'm glad you stood in my way. If you ever come by here for Jane or for me, well, your enemy is sleeping and his woman is free. Yes, and thanks for the trouble you took. From her eyes, I thought it was there for good, so I never tried. And Jane came by with a lock of your hair. She said that you gave it to her night that you planned to go clear. Sincerely, L. Cohen.
Everybody out with one Leonard Cohen song. Since there's only time left for one, I'd rather do his than mine. And I did try and translate the first verse. The first verse in English is, like a bird on a wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free. So you can all laugh now when I try to speak Spanish. Okay. Como un parrojo en un cable, como un borracho en un coro de medianoche, he intentado a mi manera de ser libre. Thank you for your kindness to my bad Spanish. Like a bird. Oh, I start in a different key. How about this one? This one will be better. Like a bird on a wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way
to be free. Like a worm on a hook, like the knight from some old-fashioned book, I have saved all my ribbons for thee. If I have been unkind, I hope that you can just let it go by. If I have been untrue, I hope you know it was never to you. But like a baby stillborn, like a beast with his horn, I have torn everyone who reached out for me. Oh, but I swear by the sun and by all that I have done wrong, I will make it all up to thee. I saw a beggar leaning on his wooden crutch. He said to me, you must not ask for so much. And a pretty woman leaning in her darkened door, she cried to me, hey, why not ask for more? Like a bird on a wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming, and to Hako for the great interview, and for the festival, which has been wonderful. I love Cartagena.